people say, gee, you guys get on a subject and you hang in there forever and you don't get around to my particular question. Well, part of what's going on here is that most previous services that try to give answers give very brief answers, and occasionally that creates an ambiguity or a misunderstanding. Mel and I dig in a little bit deeper, and so we try to get to the bottom of things and try to find out how it works and why it works. And so, yeah, we're a little long-winded when it comes to those particular subjects. There's a certain degree of people out there.
Repeater, time out.
There's a certain hardcore audience out there who keep writing to us saying, please keep doing it. I don't want to miss any one of the tech nets because you guys give the explanations I can't find anywhere else. And this week I've heard a number of people say, when it comes to antennas, boy, you guys are right on. The books don't tell me. The course doesn't tell me. My friends don't tell me. My friends don't know. The fellow amateurs I meet on the air don't know. When it comes to antennas, no one's saying that we're right all the time, but you're getting information you can't get any other way. It's sort of what we're hearing. I've got 35 years of experience of designing antennas, and that's no small subject. You take the JASIC Engineering Handbook, Antenna Engineering Handbook, 1960 McGraw-Hill, which became JASIC and Johnson in the second edition and third edition, and the fourth edition became Volakis. And it's got 1,200 pages, and in that book, the Antenna Engineering Handbook, there are approximately 5,000 individual kinds of antennas. Damn complicated subject. Highly misunderstood. The schools teach you almost nothing on that subject. And I'm talking about the majority of the very good schools. They teach you the mathematics of the foundation, of the foundation, of the physics of what in theory goes into an antenna. But no antenna engineer worth his salt today who's trying to make a living uses that. It's great material if you want to be a physics scientist about the philosophy of how antennas were being invented way back in 1960 when Maxwell was writing the equations. That's not what people use today. When a good buddy of mine who lives in Texas will tell me that whenever he opens up an article and somebody starts with the highfalutin math, he knows immediately the guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. He's putting in all kinds of fancy erudition to squid the fact that he doesn't know. And it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it tells you something about what's going on. You look over the shoulder of the people who day to day solve the Viswap problem, the bandwidth problem, the gain, and the polarization problems of whatever, of real antennas that are going through research and development and eventually being productized to be manufactured. They don't use any of that. They have a whole bunch of rules of thumb that they've learned through 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship.
Repeater, time out.
They're operating on a whole bunch of rules of thumb of antenna apprenticeship that they've gone through in 10 or 20 years, and or they've got ham radio experience. The majority of people who understand antennas and RF and propagation, the majority of have some kind of ham radio experience. They had the curiosity to get to it as a hobby, and they survived the filter of how difficult it is to learn that particular black art, and here they are today. So when it comes to antennas, we're getting all kinds of positive feedback about, yeah, that's what we want to hear. And when you've been hearing over the last couple of weeks, how do antennas behave in space? And my goodness, are there differences of opinion on that one. The way NASA does it, the way hams do it, and the way people understand it, and the way the American Radio Relay League writes about it, are multiple points of view that have significant differences. A good buddy of mine is reading the American Radio Relay League literature on the subject of antennas, which is right 98% of the time. But the literature led him to believe that whenever you listen to a signal coming from space, because the ionosphere with Faraday rotation is going to convert a linear signal into a circular polarized signal, that when that signal comes in from space, its polarization characteristics are being distorted in that manner by the ionosphere, and therefore your ground listening antenna has to be CP. Well, that is a huge mishmash. It's a slight misunderstanding of what was written. It's a huge misunderstanding of what the original person who gave the raw data before it got written down was trying to do. Let me give you an example of what's going on here. If I'm putting an antenna on a AMSAT, Amateur Satellite Corporation, AMSAT, AM Radio Satellite, and for reasons of making that satellite stable, the satellite is spinning. It's acting like a gyroscope. And so if I put a linear antenna on that satellite that is rotating, I'm going to get a signal that polarization-wise is continuously rotating. And one defense against that would be to have a circular polarized antenna on either the satellite or the ground or both. So when you're listening to an AMSAT satellite, you will, most of the time, be recommended to use a circular polarized antenna. That's question number one. That's information number one. Information number two, if I'm listening to a commercial broadcast fixed
repeater, time out.
If I'm listening to a geosynchronous satellite, commercial satellite, 22,300 miles up, because they're using frequency reuse, the odd and even channels of the 24 transponders on C-band and the 32 transponders in KU-band, they are overlapping in frequency in order to squeeze the number of channels in there that they want. They're doing frequency reuse. The odd channels are clockwise, the even channels are counterclockwise. That satellite does not rotate. It is transmitting circular polarization in order to get frequency reuse characteristics. You use your clockwise receiving antenna on the ground, and you have the ability to listen to the odd number of channels, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and so on. You use counterclockwise circular polarization on the ground, and you can listen to the even channels, 2, 4, 6, and 8. I may have that backwards, but you know what I mean. And so circular polarization on a non-rotating commercial satellite is used for frequency reuse reasons. So yes, there's a degree of truth. The ground station antenna that you use to listen to a signal from space should be circular polarized for two different reasons. A tumbling satellite when it comes to AMSAT and frequency reuse when it comes to a commercial satellite. The ionosphere itself does not convert a linear signal into a circular polarized signal due to Faraday rotation characteristics of the ionosphere. There's one interpretation you can easily get from the ARRL literature that says that. It's in error if you're getting that interpretation. It's not true. The hams who have for decades been doing 2-meter moon bounce and 6-meter moon bounce and 432 and 1296 and whatever have definitely experienced Faraday rotation. Faraday rotation means that you've got a signal going through the ionosphere, which is a plasma, mixed with a magnetic field from the Earth. And if you send out a horizontal signal from the Earth, we've got to be a little bit careful what that means, a horizontally polarized signal compared to your local reference of the ground from your place where you're sending it from Massapequa World Site, when that signal goes through the ionosphere, your horizontal signal might be, for instance, twisted in Faraday rotation to be a slant 45-degree linear polarization when it goes to the moon, bounces off the moon, comes back.
Repeater, time out.
Comes back from the moon, bounce, and goes to the ionosphere a second time and experiences another shift. The linear polarized signal comes back linear polarized, shifted in polarization, but still linear. For the most part, the ionosphere does not convert a linear signal into circular polarization. That's a pretty strongly felt opinion on my part, and I'm telling you what I think takes place 95% of the time. Oh, yes, there's a little bit of crazy secondary characteristics of a nonlinear medium that's going to give you a tiny bit of elliptical polarization. In my mind, in the experience of the guys who are doing moon bounce day in and day out, they don't experience that. It is not a dominant phenomenon. So how signals go through space? There's lots of things to talk about of orientation, referencing, polarization, whatever. How do antennas behave in general? You sit and listen to us on these technets over the years, and you're going to learn a lot about antennas. I'd like to believe the majority of it is not misinformation, but we occasionally make errors, and we admit it. Anybody who is doing anything of a threshold or of a pioneering-like nature is, by definition, doing something he doesn't thoroughly understand, otherwise he wouldn't be doing the research. If you thoroughly knew what the answer was ahead of time, you're just repeating an experiment somebody else did. And therefore, you're not doing research. If you're doing research, you're going to have an error rate. And as you push the envelope, the error rate will increase. You have to accept the fact that an error rate versus the amount of progress you're trying to make has a certain kind of a peculiar relationship. So this is my take on some of the mail I've got this week. And you can hear a little bit of my philosophy in that. Now, Mel has also got a boatload of mail. And Mel, tell us what is your take on the flack you've gotten, the compliments you've gotten, and what you think we should be doing to try to please the most number of people. And maybe we won't do that, but maybe we will. KE2KEY, you got the floor. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. You more or less summed it up pretty well, Dick. The emails I've gotten, you know, I've actually, let's put it this way, I never expected to start getting phone calls. I always said, leave it as emails this way, as Dick said, we could try to get to as many as possible. And also, I'm in the same boat with Dick. I am not really a professional typist or at the keyboard. I was pretty good at the radio teletype, the old green keys, got used to operating that. Got fairly proficient at that, but never really pursued, you know, it on a level with the ASCII type keyboard. So my hunting tech also can be slow, so I can only answer some of the basic emails I get from a lot of young people. I try to fill in their blanks. But Dick said it has gotten to a point where, how can I say? People have gotten a little hot under the collar. And the emails this week really were very controversial about the theology that we started to get into last week, Dick. Over.
Yeah, without a doubt, we got into theology. Or we touched on it. Philosophy, physics, theology, spiritual or secular approach to life. Ham radio operators are curious people. Curious people, by definition, are curious about many things. Would I be happier if I married a blonde or a brunette? Would I be happier if I used a ground plane antenna or a dipole or a Yagi antenna? Should I be on radio teletype or slow scan television or whatever? There's a zillion questions that ham radio operators could ask. And we don't restrict that as long as we're not offending anyone. I mean, how did you and I get here? What's the purpose of it all? Where do we intend to go? How did we get here? How did life form on this planet? That's a valid question. Yeah, it doesn't sound like ham radio, and some people are offended by getting into that kind of a philosophical question that doesn't have a clearly defined answer. But if you don't like us discussing that subject, you don't have to listen. The price is right. Your radio's got a whole lot of different channels you can tune it to. And if it really offends you, you can turn it off. I mean, you could say to yourself that you don't like it and you're going to change us. Well, we're a little reluctant to that. Maybe we're not going to change. If a whole lot of people tell us you're dead wrong and you really shouldn't do that, we'll probably go in that direction of what you're suggesting. But if a few people say, I hate what you're doing, and another group of people larger says, I like what you're doing and keep doing it, maybe we'll modify a little bit, but we're going to keep doing it. Yes, it's an unusual program. The fact that it has been around now for 1982 to now 27 years this coming September, 26 and a half years, and it used to be 1 hour at a time, and now it's approaching 4 hours per Sunday. Thank goodness this particular potent repeater that covers a tri-state area, good suction of a tri-state area, thank goodness on Sunday night it's relatively quiet if we weren't there. So we're not taking up somebody else's time per se. We think we're making good use of the time. If not, you'll let us know about it. But at the period of time when the repeater would have been sitting primarily silent, and we're filling it in with something else. And some people think enough value is taking place that the end is justifying the means. The benefit.
Repeater, time out.
There seem to be a significant number of people that are telling Mel and I that the risk-to-benefit ratio is in the positive sense of what we're doing. And so if a person is offended, and if you're in the minority of people that are offended, except for modifying what we're doing a little bit, we'll probably keep on doing it. If the majority of you tell us, hey, you're really dead wrong on this one, and get the hell off there doing that, I understand that. And maybe we'll do that. But we're getting enough positive feedback from enough smart people to say, keep doing it, it's unusual, but I can't get that kind of information any other place. And you guys have been there and you've done it in many of these cases. Mel, Dick, and their friends who sign in, who have got a lot of information they bring to this particular forum, is helping some people. There's a significant number of people who will from time to time write to me saying that I had a scanner, I used to be a citizen band operator, my scanner, I spun the dial one day, I stopped on 146.85 on Sunday evening, and I said, holy mackerel, these guys are having fun, I want to become a ham radio operator. There are a certain number of people out there who went and got a ham radio license because of the TechNet. I consider that a little bit of a feather in our hat. So, yeah, we know we can't please anybody. When you're covering some portion of a tri-state area, stand by a second, and you've got a big enough audience like we think we've got, you can't please everybody. A certain percentage of the people are going to be offended. We accept that. We hope they're in the minority. Eugene, did you have a couple of words you wanted to say on what I'm just saying? Go ahead, Eugene.
Yes, I do, this, Dick, W2EWK, to make it legal. Where we come from? Well, let me tell you something, Dick. I found out. I called NASA, and I talked to the head one over there, you know, from the spaceship. And he invited me to go there and see him in person. He said that we came from another planet, from another spaceship, and that's how we got here. Now we're trying to get back to our homeland. So that's the reason why we go to Mars, Venus, Jupiter. But he advised me to go to Venus just so I can pick up my mate before I go back to my homeland. QSL W2EWK.
I hear you, Eugene. Sometimes Eugene pulls our leg a little bit, and sometimes he's serious. It's not easy to tell which is which. It's another point of view. And he's allowed to have that point of view. You may not agree with it. But where did we all come from? Evolution is a factor, and sometimes we discuss that. And yes, it will violate some people's philosophy of theology. I understand that. But if you're a person who wants to answer some of the questions, if you've got curiosity, you're going to ask questions like that, and occasionally we're going to touch on that a little bit. We're not going to dwell on it. There's going to be enough antenna information, which seems to be the major thing. If I had of all the possible subjects we can discuss, it appears as though antennas is one of the biggies that people want to hear about. And Mel and I are going to try to discuss some percentage of antennas on each individual TechNet. K2KEY, is it antennas that people want to hear about, do you think, Mel? K2RIW?
Oh, no doubt that the antennas predominate the emails. The point is, the criticisms are when we start, I guess, sort of, you may say, crossing the line a little bit and getting away from amateur radio and getting into some kind of religious aspects that we touched upon last week. And one or two people did sort of get a little bit perturbed, and some statements were made, and the pros and cons started to really pile up quite a bit as to, you know, what right we have to this, or you know, accusing us of of all kinds of things, like being in allegiance with the, you'd be amazed. I don't even want to really say it. I'll keep it sometime if you're interested to our conversations on the landline, because I think some of it is very inappropriate. But the subjects that we are touching upon, you know, I think I try, like I say, the emails, as far as emails, I skip over most of those type of comments, of course, and I try to, you know, keep it as pure of ham radio as possible. And maybe that we are, like you say, causing some people to get very hot under the collar. Go ahead.
Was that Eric? Okay. As I said before, the repeater is relatively quiet on Sunday night. We're filling it with information, some of it good, some of it not so good from some people's point of view, but you don't have to listen to it. Your dial has got, you've got 800 possible frequencies. Every 5 kilohertz, you can dial on 2 meters. You can listen to another channel. You can listen to another band. You can turn it off if it offends you. You don't have to listen. And you don't have, if you're in the minority and you don't like the subject we discuss and you think you're going to control us and stop us from discussing those subjects, you might not be successful. We're persnickety. We like discussing certain subjects at certain times because we're curious. That's the nature of the people who sign in here. They're pretty wild and crazy guys. But we do, from time to time, get on some real hardcore ham radio, feed line, antennas, transmitters, receivers, propagation, satellites, moon bounce, meteor scatter type ham radio questions, digital computers tied to software-defined radios and so on. So we do get into those hardcore ham radio subjects a significant percentage of the time. But there's no guarantee we're going to be there all the time. If you think that our original charter is that we must discuss nothing but electronics, the FCC never said what ham radio operators are allowed to discuss. They're allowed to build, use, modify transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, and we have a set of frequencies that we've been allocated to use in any way we want to, as long as it doesn't have pecuniary interest, as long as it doesn't have profanity, as long as it doesn't directly offend people who happen to listen with their scanner to what we're talking about. I can dial across the 80-meter band any day and find people talking about politics. Is politics appropriate to ham radio? You bet it is. Because the politics determines whether or not your local zoning board is going to allow you to put up an antenna. It allows you to talk to your congressman who talks to the FCC chairman and modifies the rules from time to time. There are people who think that politics should not be discussed on ham radio.
It's repeater, timeout.
In my opinion, it's a perfectly appropriate subject. Should I be allowed to discuss my favorite movie and what is Julia Roberts doing and what is any of my other famous actors doing? Perfect. Some of those actors are ham radio operators. Perfectly appropriate to talk about that in the right frequency at the right time. So what subjects are not allowed to be discussed on ham radio? I'd like to believe it's an extremely small group of subjects. So from time to time, with our curiosity, we'll get into some pretty wild subjects. Hopefully we don't dwell there too long and we come back to the real world and put our feet back on the ground again. So, yeah, I'd like to believe that only some of the email you got this week was flack mail and that some of it is complimentary. I had primarily complimentary email and a few saying that, gee, I wish you would do this instead of that. I understand that. By the way, the majority of the subjects discussed on this forum, on this TechNIC, are the subjects that you guys bring. Once in a while, Mel will have a special package program on, let me drop, something like the Smith chart, or how decibels work, or I had a mini little talk on the subject of how a circulator works, or how antennas work. From time to time, we'll have a slightly packaged information presentation that we make. But the majority of the time, the subjects we discuss are the subjects that you guys bring when you sign in. What's on your mind? That's what we discuss. That's the sort of the way it's done the majority of the time. That's sort of our charter from my point of view. So if you don't like the subject, and you guys have brought up the subject, it's not always our fault. KQKEY, KQLIW on the tech bed.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, on the subject, I'll give you, for instance, what is going on. At 11 o'clock at night when it really starts to pick up, you will find at least two or three, maybe, verbal fist fights going on. This is what it's come down to. It's terrible sometimes what is happening. And because of a few people, especially, that are on 75 meters that wander around the bend and look to pick fights. It got a little out of hand a few weeks back, and one of my friends, he got a little bit perturbed, and he started to get a little bit nasty, and because this one particular person, he says, you know, he knows of our situation of operating this TechNet, and he's listened to it via one means or another, because he's not in the New York area. And he had some real... He's a hooked in TOTUS. It got out of hand, really. And I said to George, I called him, I said, listen... Ask me a question, I try to answer as best as possible to you or whoever else. No, they take this opinion that they can put their two cents in, and if you don't agree with them, then they start using, let's put it this way, colorful language. Do a little, our CW operating, Dick, where things like on CW, there's maybe... Sometimes over.
Now, in the case of CW, you'd be amazed how many people love it. Norm K2KEY, one of the primary people of the... And on the board of directors of the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. He was a CW operator, I think, from the day he cut his teeth. I mean, there are people who consider it an art form, and they get extreme enjoyment out of using Morse code. And it's no longer a requirement from the FCC. It is a slightly obsolete as far as information rate. But when it comes to saving lives, when everything else fails, and if you can tap two wires together where you can send Morse code, it's something that I'd like to believe we amateurs are going to keep as a skill. It's a darn valuable skill. And it's a great way of sending information. You may have seen that beautiful YouTube presentation of what took place on the Jay Leno show, I think about a year ago, where they had two guys who were really good at text messaging, and they had two guys that were really good at Morse code. And they held a competition on the Jay Leno show and had them send a message across the stage and find out who could send the message more rapidly and more accurately. And the Morse code operators won hands down over text messaging. Keyboard operators, so to speak, with a cell phone radio. So Morse code is a beautiful art form. I hope it doesn't die, even though it's no longer an FCC requirement. You get on to the 80-meter band, and you start discussing the pros and cons of requiring Morse code. And my goodness, when you get into heated discussions and flowery language, there are people who are fighting mad, traditional ham radio operators, where the FCC requirement, let me drop. For years and years, the FCC required demonstration of Morse code skill. For all the years of ham radio until very recently. And so when the FCC dropped that requirement, because 22 other nations on planet Earth have dropped the Morse code requirement for getting a primary FCC license, or the equivalent of a ham radio license in your particular country, 22 other countries have dropped it, and the FCC decided to join them. Where I guess we were the 23rd. So there are people who are fighting mad over that, that the FCC should never be allowed to do that, that it should be the major filter that keeps out the whiz kids and space cadets, so to speak, and that we're going to go to hell in a handbasket. Well, we haven't. We've had no ham radio, we had no Morse code requirement now for a significant number of years, and ham radio has not changed that rapidly to the worse. There's an awful lot of people I know, good engineering background people, who for whatever reason just don't have the gumption, or there's something, a little bit of a mental block. They weren't able to pass Morse code muster and therefore didn't get a ham radio license. And all of a sudden, without the ham radio, without the Morse code requirement, a hell of a lot of people went and got a license who wouldn't ordinarily have one, and some of them are darn nice people, and I'm glad we got them. And by the same token, you could say some terrible things about CW, citizen band operators if you want to. There's some extremely nice ham radio operators who cut their teeth in electronics, in wireless electronics, by Citizens Band. We shouldn't discriminate against those. Let me drop. There are are people who have come from all kinds of various backgrounds, countries, ethnicity, religious, whatever. You can't discriminate against them. A Morse code operator, a hater or a lover. A citizens band operator, hater or lover. A person who is Spanish or English or French or Irish or whatever, Russian. You can't like or dislike them because of that as a background. That's not a proper criteria. How do you determine what is a proper criteria for a good ham radio operator? A guy who's curious and interested in the subject of wireless communication. And even some of those are primarily computer-oriented people that use just the wireless portion of it as a tool in order to have computer A talk to computer B across a certain distance. And to them, it's just a tool, and the real communication is taking place when computer A talks to computer B. Those are perfectly valid people. So you got to be careful how we discriminate. I'd like to believe that a person who is properly educated gets around the problem of discrimination. That's an opinion. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, that's, you know, one man's opinion, really, as they say, because I sure get a lot of opposite opinions about a lot of things that CW, I don't even want to really touch upon that because say on 75 meters what goes on. Well, usually that's what it'll, the insults start with, is somebody will say something and say, oh, well, you know, without, no wonder you're on the stand because, you know, without CW, let in all kinds of people. I mean, this is where it starts. I've heard this comment so many times. They look up in QRZ or whatever and they see the length of the time of your licensing. Of course, right away they can sort of get an idea as to whether W came through the CW ritual of ham radio or whether you, you know, came in on the situation without the no-code license. So it's terrible. It's usually some of them terrible. They actually have told people, I heard them, if you try to join certain people on there, they right away, immediately look up all letters and just all names. Right away, say, we don't permit non-CW operators on our group or whatever. It's like I say, some of the stuff, Vic, is, I wouldn't even repeat what's going on. And in fact, like I say, it got so bad that we've cut out our 75-meter nightly net. And I have more or less now settled into most of my HF operating right now is CW. And in fact, I got a number of questions that came in here about one of the bands that we talked about, 160 meters with. So that's where it stands right now, Dick, but I guess I have to be in some way, somewhat, I don't know how to approach it, but I guess maybe a little bit more conservative to maybe some of these hotheads off, over.
Okay.
WS2N.
All recognized. I'm going to try, but I don't guarantee it. If a real nice guy asks a sincere question that's in one of the so-called forbidden areas, but he's not really committing profanity, he's not intentionally doing something to offend people, I'm going to allow the question. I think we can have a meaningful question among smart people on this TechNet on almost any subject in the world, including sex, reproduction, religion, all of the so-called delicate subjects, with good taste, can be discussed, in my opinion. You may not agree. You don't have to listen. You've got an on-off switch and you've got a frequency dial. You can go somewhere else if this offends you. If you think you're going to change us and our philosophy, you might not be successful. Been around for 26 years, and that's an interesting track record. And we're still here. There was one serious group of people who tried to eliminate us roughly 10 years ago. Could say that that group of people got eliminated. They're gone and we're still here. They got offended. There was a group of people who thought that Sunday is a day of rest and the repeater should be quiet on Sunday. Well, that's an opinion. But it's a communication medium. It's a channel that was being unused and we're using it. And there are a significant number of people who think that the cost, that the benefit to unbenefit, the benefit to risk ratio of what we're doing is primarily favorable. Not all the time, but primarily favorable. Paul, from the US2N, what's going on in space? What do you believe about all this? Tell us whatever's on your mind. You got it, Paul.
I hope the net lasts a couple of more decades. Dick, I just wanted to make a quick report. Hope I'm making it okay. Right now I'm on my HT. If I have a problem, I'll go back on the other rig. But STS-119 did take off. I missed the first 15 minutes of the net. I don't know if you mentioned that or not. Roughly about 3 hours ago. So it did take off. They've eliminated that problem. They consider it a risk with the release valve for the hydrogen tanks that they found crack in it on the Endeavour flight, and that's what held everything up. But they did take off successfully, and they're up there now. In a couple of days, they'll dock with the International Space Station, and we'll get that final set of solar panels installed. It's taken four actual independent flights to put all four sets onto the space station. So I really wanted to make that report, Dick. And how am I doing on the repeater? If I have a problem, I'll go on the other radio. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
A tiny bit of noise in the background, but you're coming through quite well, Paul. I know that there was an oxygen link in a piece of tubing that was supposed to direct the escaping hydrogen away from the pad as a safety item, and that delayed, I guess, the last Thursday attempt, and they reattempted today. And the launch itself, I think 8 minutes after the launch, was supposed to, if it was clear enough, become a visual as it went by the Long Island area, so to speak, out in the Atlantic. I wonder if you're out in the field doing that observation, Paul, and I wonder if you saw the space shuttle go by. I know that the last time they declared one of these space shuttle observable situations, I went to my local schoolyard with my telescope and binoculars, and my goodness, did I see a beautiful shuttle go by. So I wonder if that's what you saw tonight. I'm hoping it was clear enough. WS2N, K2RIW.
It was not clear enough in Ronkonkoma, but I don't know. I've tried a couple of the night flights going up to the space station, and even years ago going up to the Mir. I never saw any of them. Because, you know, I was too low on the horizon you know, I'd have to go down by the water. Years ago when before the going up to the space station, they used to go at a higher inclination, trying to achieve as close to a polar orbit as they could for some of the space flights. That I did see, and that was great. You see that quite clearly. It was probably about 45 degrees in the off the horizon, and that was great. But no, didn't see anything tonight. But I'm glad they got up there. A month delay. If they didn't get up this week, they would have had to wait until April, probably late April, because they have a Soyuz flight going up very shortly. In fact, I think they want to cut back a day or so on this flight. They might do that because it's running into the timeline. They can't have both vehicles up there on deck. So it looks good. This completes the main portion of the spacecraft. They're looking for people to name the new node. There's a node that's supposed to go up there. That's another pretty good sized piece, and that's going to contain the cupola, lookout view, half a dozen trapezoidal windows with a one big window overhead with big shutters on the outside. That'll probably be, I guess, at the end of the year. And that will really finish off the space station, Dick. They want to name that one. They've named the other nodes Harmony and Unity. They get the schools right in and all that. And they want to name this next node that's going up with a cupola that will be attached to it. But it's wrapping up. Not much longer we won't be seeing these shuttles go up. Not much of a chance to see them in the future, Dick. Back to you, WS2N. Hi, Beck.
All right, Dick.
a very noisy other signal I heard in there. A quick question I've got for you, Paul, while you're still with us, and that is, I hear tell that these extra solar panels that they're going to be enabling give them a lot more electrical input, which gives them the ability to maintain 6 astronauts on the International Space Station instead of the current 3. And I guess one of the guys that's up there is going to come back down and a new guy is going to be left. So roughly how much more solar panel input or kilowatts, what's really going on so that these extra solar panels of this particular flight will enable 6 people to be on board instead of 3? Give me a couple of words on that one, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW.
Kilowatts, a little bit more than 60 kilowatts will be added. Well, it's just the completion of it. I mean, they could probably do it now. I mean, last week they brought up another more facilities, bathrooms, compartments for food and this and that. It's just, they really loaded it up last time. So I think this is just going to complete that. I don't really, I guess it was a requirement to have all the panels attached. They want the whole thing working properly. A lot of time is spent maintaining the space station with the three-person crew they have on board. A lot of science is being done, but that's what you're going to really have. You're going to have 2 or 3 people maintaining this thing, and then with a lot of science going on. That's what they're looking forward to for the next 10 or 15 years, Dick. So I think they just want to put everything into order, you know, make sure the solar panels are rotating properly and get everything running just right, and then they'll have the permanent crew. Originally they planned on 8, but it dropped down to 7, and now it's 6. But that's what they plan on doing. That means they're going to have to leave 2 Soyuz spacecrafts up there. The lifeboats. By the way, they utilized that the other day. There was a piece of space junk that went close within a mile square around that space station, and they needed to go into the in case the thing broke apart. They would have escaped. The closest call that they did have was some space junk. They found out about a little too late. They do have the capability, and they have moved the whole space station out of the way of other space junk. But I guess early next year they'll probably have the permanent crew. Dick, back to you.
Okay, for a little bit of an explanation, Paul is coming in on the eastern input, the 147.375.975 input, and Eric, KE2EJ, and Andy, DeBay2CDO, have been working on that system lately. The audio from there being coupled into this repeater is beautiful. Coming in by way of a computer link, an IRLP link, and that audio is nicely set. We're still doing a little bit of work on that repeater to make the receiver a little bit more sensitive. That's part of the reason why you heard Paul dropping out a little bit. What Paul was also mentioning is that the astronauts did climb into the Soyuz this week and dwell there for a couple of hours while that piece of space junk came by. They discovered this piece of space junk in too short a period of time where they didn't have the time to move the International Space Station out of the way. They knew that the piece of space junk is going to come within I think it's a 2.5 mile square. And so had it, this 5-inch diameter piece of junk, had it hit a critical area of the International Space Station, it could have rammed a hole in the side where the air rushes out, and you'd get a kind of almost explosive decompression. And so by putting the astronauts into the Soyuz, if that occurred, you've got a few minutes of warning, so to speak, as the air is draining out of the International Space Station. They would close the door on the Soyuz, and they would be safe. They'd be in the lifeboat, and then they've got a number of options as to what they can do. Whereas if you're in the International Space Station while it's being depressurized, and if you're in one of the modules that doesn't have the doors closed between you and the failing module, the air that you're breathing is rapidly being drained out that hole, and life gets real complicated real fast. So in that eventuality, they went into the Soyuz to be in a safe location. And I think it was only the second or third time in the history of the International Space Station where that safety requirement had to be exercised. Okay, anybody with any further questions on Paul and space and what took place this week, you give me your call letter's name right now, KQRIW on the TechNet.
And I'm back on the other radio, Dick, just in case. I don't want to drop out.
Okay, you sound rather good. Anything you want to add on what I just said, Paul? Go ahead.
No, that's very good. And nothing I want to add to that. I'm looking forward to this mission. You could follow it along, four different spacewalks. Very, very busy. It's an unbelievable piece of structure. Anybody that hasn't listened to the net, this thing is, after being installed, these solar panels are 240 feet long by 40 feet wide. So when they unfurl them, it's called the S6 truss segment. And it should be quite interesting. Also, if you go onto the internet, NASA.gov, you look at where the press, they have the press release and the different topics right on the main page. You can click on its PDF file for the hydrogen flow relief valve system. And they have close-up views of it. They have close-up views of where it's located on the shuttle, what its purpose is to keep the hydrogen tanks pressurized properly at 33 psi. What happens is the tanks, as they empty, it creates kind of like a vacuum behind it. It's liquid. It's pouring in through these 17-inch diameter lines into the space shuttle during liftoff. Well, this vacuum behind it would tend to reduce the pressure behind it. So what they do is they have gaseous hydrogen that's coming into the spacecraft into its tanks, and they take the gaseous part, and that goes through this relief valve back into the upper part of the hydrogen tanks, and which keeps the pressure equal. This poppet valve, that operates in this relief type valve, was giving them problems, and that's what this whole delay was about. But boy, they give you an extensive view and a little pretty good explanation of the purpose behind this valve. And of course, the NASA.gov site is filled with tons of information on this flight or any other flight.
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, you did drop out for the last 30 seconds, and Paul was telling us about the advantage of going to NASA.gov and reading about that valving system for the hydrogen. Paul, give me a rough guess if you happen to know. The solar panel improvement that's going to be made on this particular Endeavour mission, what percentage of solar panel area increase or wattage increase? Is it a 10 or a 20% increase of the solar panels that are going to take place because of this particular mission? If you happen to know, Paul, go ahead.
25%. Like I said, this is 240 feet by 40 feet. If you look at them, it looks like two sets of panels. That's the way it looks. But, I mean, it sends up in one big mission. So you have this set, another set went up another time, another set before that, another one. So there's three sets like that. You have two on the port side right now and one on the starboard. If you go to any of the pictures for the ISS, the updated pictures, after Endeavour left last time there, we take pictures. You'll see these three sets of panels, two on the port and one on the starboard side. This will be an extension of that on the starboard side. So you're increasing it by 25%. And boy, the robot arms, they all, like when they did the port side, they all have to extend all the way out. It's very interesting. To see how they do this, it's everything's extended all the way as far as they can go, So, you know, if you can get any of the live, you know, live shots from the NASA channel or something like that, or hopefully on the news, keep your fingers crossed for that. It's really an incredible engineering feat, I think. Back to you.
And one last question I'd like to know, Paul. What's the total number of kilowatts of electrical power that these solar panels are generating? And I believe that amount of excess power now is so significant that when future space shuttle dockings take place, that the electronics that keeps the space shuttle properly operating while it's docked with the International Space Station used to be using the fuel cells on the space shuttle and consuming the available oxygen for powering those fuel cells on board. They were using up the consumables on the space shuttle. And now that all that excess electrical power is coming from the solar panels, I believe the International Space Station can now be pouring electrical power into the shuttle during the docking. Therefore, none of the consumables per se on the shuttle have to be consumed. Therefore, the shuttle can dock for a much longer period of time, if I understand correctly. So what's the total number of kilowatts, if you happen to know, that the solar panels can now or soon will be generating? And am I correct in making a guess that that excess power now is going to be very handy when it comes to long periods of docking of the shuttle to the space station? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's 66 kilowatts per set. So 6, 12, 18 watts. So 240 probably kilowatts for the station. I believe that's the number. So the missions used to be 11, maybe 12 days long. Now, ever since, I guess, about 6 or 7 flights ago, I guess a year and a half ago, they had enough power from these solar panels. They had enough up there where they could divert the power to the shuttle, essentially jumping cables to the shuttle, doing exactly what you said. And now they are able to have extended missions. And that brought them up to 3-day missions extended. Now with this set of panels, they would actually have even longer missions. You could probably go, you know, 5 days maybe, 4 or 5 days. Unfortunately, the shuttle program is coming to an end, but not to fear, eventually when we have the new Orion system built and going up there, that will have the capability of staying there probably forever. You know, I mean, just tremendous amount of power for a craft that big, because that'll be much smaller than the space shuttle itself. So you'll be able to have these things docked for long periods of time. As it is, you leave the Soyuz. Every Soyuz craft that goes up stays 6 months, and then eventually a crew brings that back, and a new crew, you know, brings up the other one. So those small Soyuz craft stay 6 months at a time. But the shuttle has, you know, needed a lot more power, and this really changes things for extended missions. Back to you,
Dick. Unfortunately, you just gave me another question, Paul, and that is, the shuttle is due to be discontinued in the next couple of years. The Orion, which is the replacement, is not going to be available for a longer number of years, so there's a few years of gap in between where we'll be thoroughly dependent on the Soviets to do all of the restocking and bringing up astronauts and cosmonauts and whatever. The shuttle will be abandoned. From what you're hearing, is there any possibility of changing that timing? I'm for one, uncomfortable about the fact that we abandon the shuttle while it's still operational, and while the Orion is not yet operational, and we're creating multiple years of gap in between, and therefore we don't have a backup system for more than one way of doing launches to the International Space Station. I'm uncomfortable with that. I hope I'm not alone. Is there any possibility, in your opinion, that game plan, as it is right now, can be modified? Very similar to we were going to thoroughly abandon Hubble, and now there's going to be at least one more Hubble repair mission in the fall of 2009. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, like 2010 is the end of the space shuttle system. They're sticking with that. That gives you about 4 years for the Orion system to go online, which is essentially one of the solid booster rockets, redesigned solid booster rocket that they use for the space shuttle with an Apollo-style craft on top. That will carry up to 6 astronauts to the space station, where this one can carry, 7 and 8. But let's see now. There was a proposal right after the Obama administration took over to change this whole setup. Right now, you're going to have heavy cargo lift vehicle launch heavy things up to the space station. No people on board. When you go to the moon, same heavy cargo lift vehicle, as big as the space shuttle now, is huge. Actually, would stand higher than the space shuttle stands today. We'll be lifting the lunar lander, any heavy components, future modules that they might want to put up there. Who knows? Will be put on this heavy lifter, supplying the space station. Let me drop it. They'll use this cargo type vehicle, which, by the way, looks like they're using an external tank and then a couple of solid boosters attached to that. That's what that's going to look like with the cargo on top. People will always be launched with the single rocket setup, and that will be ready first, which is good, but, 4 years down the road. So Popular Science had an article where there was a proposal to do away with this whole setup and just build a cargo setup and put people on top, and I haven't heard anything after that one article. They said it would have made it like 2 or 3 years down the road. The time period would have been shorter. I like the way it's being designed now. They call it the whole constellation system. I like the idea of a separate cargo on one vehicle and astronauts on the other. I think the initial proposal is right. The only problem is they're way behind schedule. They should have proposed this a long time ago. And unfortunately, we'll have a gap. Another craft supplying the space station, let me drop it, is being built by ILLI and launched by the European Space Agency. They've already done one of them, and there's a couple more down the pike. Very large looking capability of maybe 6 times the amount of equipment and supplies that could be supplied by the Progress ships. Progress ships are being launched by Russia and have been many years on a regular basis. They are unmanned. The one being launched by European Space Agency, also unmanned, and that independently docks with the space station for supplies, but doesn't bring people. So we are going to have to rely on the Soviets for at least 2 or 3 years, probably looks like 4 years, hopefully not longer than that. Back to you.
And as I said, I'm uncomfortable with that. I hope that game plan gets modified a little bit. Thank you, Paul. Good stuff. Mel, looks like the majority of what I'm hearing and some of what you're hearing is that people want to hear about antennas. And I'll bet you've got some antenna questions in your mailbag. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, very interesting, Paul, as always. And hearing your report weekly on what's going on up there. Let's see. Yeah, all right, let's get to a couple here. There, see what we got. Well, let me tell you, I got a phone call. And this person that called me, he is with a company that manufactures one of a very popular vertical antenna. And it sort of got back to him that we have been sort of giving some flack to the fact that I mentioned that I feel that you can take a dipole and put it in maybe some kind of a vertical or somewhat of a slope, or most of what I've done, and I think it'll work.